Yeah, but it's early, but since everyone seems to be here, we resume the hearing. Mr. Todd, you're here for a number of parties, headlined, I might say that, by Mr. and Mrs. Burden Senior.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to appear this afternoon. I appear for the parties that are set out in paragraph one of my written submission. With me is Mr. Gresson from my office and also Ms. Hayley Mann, who has produced a brief of evidence for you. And so in terms of other witnesses who wish to speak, they are mainly members of the Burden family, although, and I'll introduce them each as I call them, also with here today Mr. and Mrs. Don and Vicky McRae and their son Duncan McRae from Alpha Burn Station at Glendu Bay, as distinct from Glendu Station. That's another family of the McRae's, so just that we've got the right people identified. As I said, I've prepared a written brief. I don't know if you want me to take you through that or just to highlight some of the issues that are a particular concern to my clients. I can do either, whatever suits.
Thank you, Mr. Todd. We've had the opportunity to read your submissions, so we don't need you to take us through them. If you want to highlight some matters, and then
yes,
we might have one or two questions for you before we go on to... What do you want to see? Presumably you'll address us first.
Yes.
Do you want to hear your...
No, I'll call Ms. Mann, seeing she's here, and she's prepared a summary statement, which hopefully, again, will save time, be economical in terms of hearing time, and then I'll call the individual lay witnesses.
One point of clarification, I thumbed my way through Ms. Mann's summary, which helpfully has a map of each of your submitters. It admits, I don't think she needs to tell me where the Hawea Community Association is from.
Yeah.
And Courts Commercial, I think, is the land behind the pub at
Hawea. That's correct.
And you'll be talking to us about that at a later stage.
Well, it's the land including the pub and behind.
The point of issue is the bare land behind the pub.
Yes.
And Mr. Rodwell, where is he from?
Mr. Rodwell actually owns a property which is on the northern side of the historic Shotover Bridge at...
Tucker's Beach?
On the opposite side of Tucker Beach.
Right.
So on the northern side, which is the old, what some of you, I know Commissioner Dawson may recall, is part of the property was known as the Flower Barn that was located there.
Mr. Todd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the main issue for the people that I represent is the fact that this is quite a foreign process to not only them, but also myself. And I can't recall in 40 years of practice ever having to be involved in a submission such as this. With the greatest respect to the mana whenua, the problem that my clients have got is that they wake up in the morning without any consultation whatsoever and find that there are notations marked over significant parts, if not all of their properties, which purports to provide for interests that mana whenua have in respect of their land. Nobody had consulted with them concerning this. Indeed, both in terms of the Burdens and the McRae's, they had both been through in the previous 15 years, 10-year review in respect to their properties, where there had been consultation with mana whenua in terms of whether or not the iwi had any interests in their properties. And in terms of the McRae's, there was none on Alpha Burn Station, and I've got that for you a letter of confirmation to that respect. And Mr. Burden will tell you in respect of the tenure review for Glendene Station, which runs along the true left bank of Lake Harweir up to the neck, that there was an area identified at the neck of interest, but nowhere else on the property. Now, what the concern is basically the landowners then post-notification of the stage of the proposed district plan, which incorporated these notations into the proposed district plan, took the opportunity that was offered to consult with Mana Whenua representatives, and I in fact attended that consultation meeting with them. During that meeting, they sought to ascertain from the representatives as to why they had not been consulted in respect to the notations, but more importantly, what was the areas of interest over their properties to the Mana Whenua. Those questions were not answered at all. The McRaes in particular then took the opportunity to invite members of the iwi to come out to the property and to sit down and with them and discuss the matters with them, and again that invitation was not accepted. So we have a scenario where effectively the landowners are flying in the dark in terms of the future use of their properties. And whilst I could be accused of overstating that issue.
Surely not.
Well, I'd hope not, because that is exactly what the problem is. If there had been even some general identification of issues or interests in respect of the properties, at least the landowners would then have the ability to know that and be able to plan their activities and their operations on their farming properties in the knowledge that those areas generally were of importance to the Mana Whenua or the iwi. Whereas what we have at the moment is basically they don't know. And so therefore, another layer of regulatory control is going to be imposed over those properties. And that in turn is going to require the landowners, whenever they seek to undertake certain activities, and the threshold is pretty low in some cases, they are going to be required to consult and with, on an almost compulsory basis, I would suggest, with the iwi representative entities. And if they don't, they run the risk that their applications for such activities may be at best subject to limited notification, but at worst subject to public notification, which may result in issues arising which have got nothing to do with the Wahi Tupuna notifications over their properties. And that in a nutshell is their concern, because this is going to result in additional costs, additional delay, and quite frankly, additional concern, because once these notations go on these properties, there's no going backwards in terms of the notification of interest in respect to those properties. And as I say, in regards to most of the properties which I represent, significant parts of them are subject to these notations. And if we then accept that we have a scenario where there is no specifics and there's just this general notation over large portions, if not all of the properties, what is the next step in 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 or 50 years? I'm representing families today who are third generation farmers of these properties, and who have children and grandchildren lining up to take over those farming operations. What does this whole process mean for them down the track? And that is really, in a nutshell, and I'm, again, hopefully I'm not overstating it, hopefully I'm not being disrespectful to anybody, all that my clients really are asking is that they have the opportunity to sit down with somebody who can inform them, even in a general sense, acknowledging the sensitivities that might exist in respect of some of these sites, and understanding that mana whenua do not want it generally known or publicly known what their specific interests might be in specific areas. They just want the opportunity to sit down and understand why somebody has a particular interest in their property to the extent that that interest is now giving them a right much greater than the public at large. And I don't think I can simplify it much much more than that. It's a level of control which, as I said from the outset, is quite foreign in terms of the Act. And having read other submissions that have been presented to you, I accept that we seem to have a tension existing now in terms of particularly the issues in Part 2 of the Act, in terms of the different interests, acknowledging Section 8 and the treaty obligations, acknowledging Section 6 and the issues of national importance. But there's also the importance of people and their communities and their social and economic well-being and all of those matters, and then that you have to measure up against those. So those are the comments that I'd like to make in opening. And I'm happy to answer any questions concerning those or matters that we've raised in our formal submission.
Thank you, Mr. Tom. I'll kick off. Talking about the evidential basis, submissions you've made about the evidential basis for mapping the plain to permanent areas. Assertion. Is that what you're saying, what we've got now? It's mere assertion.
What we've got, it appears, is something which has been put to the council and accepted, I would almost say blindly, by the council or without any independent assessment. It's a bit like saying to Don McRae, he wants a rule in the plan where he can take 100 merinos and put them in the main street of Queenstown and farm them as of right. And the council don't even question the costs and benefits associated with doing that. Now, that's putting it very, very simply, I appreciate. But what we're saying here is that it appears that the council, acknowledging that they may not have any in-house expertise or in relation to these cultural issues, have simply taken the evidence and not had anybody look at it independently. And they could have gone out and got independent parties to consider what had been put to them, and they've just dropped it into the district plan, again, without any consultation with any of the landowners that were directly affected, and without any analysis of the costs and benefits of doing that. And that is totally contrary to the provisions of the Resource Management Act that we all have to live with.
Trying to think of an analogy.
Yes, but at least in my experience with how the council have gone about things, they've had drop-in sessions, they've had staff doing presentations at the local AMP show. They've done all of these things. There was no effort to do any of that in terms of these provisions. And I think the other thing that has to be acknowledged here, that yes, while I agree with what you're saying, often a landowner would not be subject to provisions in a generic sense such as this, or a group of landowners. The nearest analogy I can give you is a case that Mr. Gresson and I have just been involved in, whereby we acted for some landowners in downtown Queenstown that had had pedestrian linkages notified through their properties. Interestingly enough, again, without any consultation before that was done. And we took the case, we submitted against these linkages being through these specific properties on the basis that they amounted to a de facto designation over the properties, and there was no financial compensation, no financial or any other form of compensation that was being made available to the landowners. The hearings panel, I'm not sure if any of you were on those panels, rejected that argument and confirmed the linkages. So we appealed that to the Environment Court, and the Environment Court has accepted our appeal and directed the council to remove them. That's the nearest analogy that I can get to with what is proposed here, because what the court was saying there is that those linkages were for a benefit of a third party, namely the public, yet the council was not taking any financial responsibility for them. The issue that we have here is, it's worse than that in some respects, is that what we have here is something that is for the benefit of a third party, and again, I'm not being disrespectful when I refer to Mana Whenua as a third party. What I'm saying, that these Wahi Tupuna notations are for their, generally are for their benefit, and when the person that's affected by the notations seeks to understand them and understand what values are trying to be protected, they're shut out of that process, and indeed they will only possibly find out if there is a particular interest by having to meet the costs of consultation with that party, and there's no guarantee that they'll still find out what the interest is. Presumably, the iwi could simply say, we're not giving our consent. Or has any consideration been given to inquiring, would they have to justify the reason for withholding their consent?
What if I could ask Mr. Gresson to give the hearing administrator the citation of the case you're referring to in Central?
Yes, certainly. It's Skyline and Skyline Enterprises Limited and Trojan Holdings Limited. And the Queenstown Lakes District Council will be 2020 in the last 3 weeks. The cost decision has yet to be released.
I'm interested because we'll be hearing tomorrow from Aurora, who are looking for reverse sensitivity provisions around their substations later in these hearings. And what you describe seems to ring small bells in my head.
Yes.
Another point of clarification. Beach Cottage Trustees, is that Blenheim has property or is that next door?
No, it's next door. Across, I'm trying to think of the name of the road that runs
Waterfall
down
Park.
To the... Sorry?
Waterfall Creek. Right.
Waterfall Creek, yeah. It's the Dippy property.
Ruby Island Road. Yeah. I think it's Ruby Island Road, isn't it?
Sorry, you could be Ruby Island Road, yeah.
Good that the council knows where it is. question. We heard from the representatives of a different group of rural landowners this morning. We were talking about 10-year review and the extent to which Mount Whenua values were and are considered in that process. And I posed a question there about whether the focus in 10-year review was on individual sites rather than the broad-scale cultural landscape values that Waiheke Te Puna seeks to address. Now, I'll pose that question to you and in order that partly that your witnesses can talk to me further about it. What's your answer, Mr. Todd?
Is
it the same process?
Yes, it is. And the answer is that when a property is put up for 10-year review, then the whole of the property is up for consideration, not just the part that's being freeholded. And the first cut, if you like, at 10-year review before you get to the process where effectively the terms of the 10-year review are resolved. And Mr. Burden Senior will remind me of the name of that. It's just slipping. It slipped my mind for a moment. Is that iwi, as well as other parties, fish and game, and those types of parties, all get the opportunity to make submissions on the initial proposal, and to identify what goes on in terms of, to identify what issues relating to the property are of interest to them. And given the scale of the properties, the size of the properties that we're talking about, I would suggest to you that it's a lot more than just specific sites. For example, I've just been handed up a copy of the cultural values report for the Glendene pastoral lease 10-year review, and we can make available a copy of that report for you so you can see the detail. That was undertaken in February 2004, the detail that goes into the identification of these issues and the assessments that are undertaken. It's called the Cultural Values Report for Glendene Pastoral Lease.
The only question is, are there any issues of confidentiality that we need to be aware
no,
of?
No, it's a public document.
It's on public, domain?
Yes. And I have a similar letter from Land Information New Zealand who administer 10-year review in relation to the 10-year review for Alpha Burn Station, which confirmed that there was, and I'll just read from it, our records show that Alpha Burn Station was inspected by Ngāi Tahu representatives on the 27th of April 1995. However, no written report of this inspection was requested by Land Information New Zealand or produced by Ngāi Tahu.
Now, the answer is yes, we would be grateful.
I have copies of that already available.
I don't think we need proof in that sense, but I'm happy to take your advice that Linz have provided that information.
Yes. Well, there's copies here available for
yes,
you.
Thank you. Next question. Talking about the absence of a cost-benefit assessment, you'll be aware, as I am, that the High Court said in the Project Hayes appeal, that there is no obligation to undertake a cost-benefit assessment in an RMA setting, certainly not in a resource consent setting.
Well, that's the distinction I was going to come to, because with respect, and I'll need to find some authority for you on this, but it's my view that the position is totally different on a plan change or review of a district plan as it is on a resource consent.
My recollection of the logic was that the court would say there's no obligation to assess the costs of intangibles, in that case outstanding landscape values,
yes,
or allegedly outstanding landscape values. There was an issue about whether it was or was not an O&L,
but
the broader point is, like, so there is an issue about the logic. I understand the point you make about distinction, that whether the logic of the High Court would still apply, and also the fact that, of course, Section 32 says if practicable.
Well, in terms of at least the analysis of the costs to the landowner, and Ms. Mann touches on this in her summary, surely an analysis of those costs or the ongoing costs associated with the notations would not have been difficult to undertake. And that type of cost did not arise in terms of Project Hayes or a resource consent. This is not a one-off. These are going to be ongoing costs that the community affected by these notations are going to have to bear as a bare minimum going forward. And as I said before, I think once these notations are in place, everybody would accept that there's no going back in terms of having them removed from particular properties. It would be extremely difficult, I would suggest, to do so or to justify doing so.
Point about paragraph 35, that's the PDP must give effect to matters in the RPS and the strategic directions, must do it at any cost. Does that depend on how directive those provisions are?
Yes, I agree that is. That would be logical. I think the difficulty that we have here is that we're getting to the debate about these notations as part of stage three of the plan, and part of the frustration is that possibly this should have been an issue that was dealt with as part of those strategic objectives and policies as part of stage one of the plan.
My view, the counterpoint might be, we've done that at stage one, we'd have to be redoing it because the RPS has emerged in the meantime.
Yes, possibly, but the RPS was fairly well down the track, even at stage one, I think, if I recall correctly.
Yes, but it didn't say a lot.
True.
Got more specific as it went along.
Yes, it has. I acknowledge that. And I acknowledge that, I'm the first to acknowledge that the RPS says that there should be mapping, right? And generally, there is an acceptance of that on the basis that the mapping justifies the interest in the properties. And that's the distinction. We've got no issue about mapping specific areas of particular interest where values can be identified. But what we've got here is such generalisation, both in terms of the mapping and in terms of the threats, that frankly they're incapable of being understood by not only the landowners but users of the plan.
Questions?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just a
Sorry, would you mind just speaking up? It's very difficult. Thank you. Correct. Yeah. And the conversation, I would have suspected, would not have been difficult to have in respect of that with the landowners, and they would have respected that, as they have through processes like tenure review, where those types of conversations do occur. Yes, it is.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. One question for me, really. I just want to be clear. Paragraph 3 of your legal submission, where you said it's a missing deletion of or the removal of the property, and then the end is the alternative, which is to reduce the revenue burden. And then you just said, we've got no problem about specific revenue, why the value is clear, which is what the students talk about. Your witness has only focused, I think, on the alternative idea, the provisions right. So, can you just be clear? So, is it that your clients are abandoning the idea of deleting them, but make sure we get the provisions right, or is it, unless you get the provisions right, we therefore seek deletion?
Correct. The latter. Yeah, right. Because basically what we're saying, get rid of the general provisions and let's get down to specifics.
So,
if those specifics do exist in respect of individual properties. Well, they may not be happy with it, but they may, depending on the evidence, be required to accept that. Like occurs on any district plan review, where specific values, for example, O&L values, most of these landowners have been through that process extensively and have those notations over their properties as well.
Need to accept that there will be some provisions in the plan.
And there may be some mapping on their properties as well.
So I'm not sure, because my understanding from Mr. Commissioner Hill's question was when he was talking about the provisions, he meant the rules.
Yes.
The policies and the rules. Whereas you'll be talking about which may need to be made more precise.
Yes.
But you're also talking about the mapping, which needs to be made more precise.
Yes.
So when you say, if we get the provisions right, then maybe some mapping and some rules might be acceptable. Are you saying that both the mapping and the rules need to be right?
Correct.
Yes. So we're not talking about more specific rules and still having the generalised mapping.
Correct.
All right. That's
sorry if I didn't make that clear.
No, that's fine.
That's probably my loose question.
No.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. In the case of both landscape categories and natural hazards, I suppose there's been a refinement of information over time. Maybe that approach started to be broad brush earlier on and has become more specific. Is it your
Yes.
So if we look at tenure review, and I asked some questions of your colleagues this morning on tenure review, if there was a value that was of significance, and typically a site that was significant, would it have been the case that that would have been held with the Crown and with the Conservation Estate?
Not necessarily held with the Crown, but it would certainly been identified and provided for as part of the tenure review process.
The tenure review conditions, there might have been a protected area?
For example, and Mr. Burden will talk about this, there was areas identified at the neck between Lake Wanaka and the top of Lake Hawea as part of the Glendine tenure review. I don't believe that those areas are actually held as Crown land now. They've been taken out and have been assigned or held in ownership by the Mana Whenua.
Can I agree there, Graham? Yeah.
Sorry.
Can I agree there?
Yeah. When you come up, you can clarify that. I may have that wrong.
That's okay. I explored with some of your colleagues last week and week before the idea, the concept that in this case the council are reliant on Mana Whenua through Kakaha or Te Amarama or whatever the mechanism is for advice, expert advice relating to Mana Whenua values on a particular site. They're also then, that party is then also then the affected party. And maybe required to provide affected party approval. Are you aware of any situation where the same party is both the advisor to the council and the affected party?
No.
No. And do you see any issues with that?
Well, I think the issue's obvious. That there is that there is potential. As I earlier mentioned, for example, an affected party approval or written approval to be withheld without any reason being given at all, the potential, and I can't say that's going to happen. At the very least, there is a situation which exists where, in this particular case, on the own evidence for the council, it, as I understand that evidence, the council simply took it at face value, what it was being told, and took those maps and put them into the district plan. They undertook no independent analysis of it whatsoever.
And following on from that, does it follow that one organisation can provide affected party approval for all Mana Whenua values, or what Iwi values?
As I understand, that's not the case, and as particularly in the Queenstown Lakes District.
So does that make difficulties in affected party approval? Does that actually solve any problems from one or more parties if there's potentially...
Well, it's solved if you get affected party approval from both, but
just
if you...
Both.
Sorry? Well, at the moment, as I understand it, there is two entities that consider most applications, depending upon where they sit within the district. And there is no guarantee that one or both will give the same answer in terms of their interest in the property.
And even if both were to provide, would that cover off all...
I believe that the council would take that as being the position, whether or not that's legally correct or, but that is that's as I understand it how that currently works.
Okay, and regard to the 400 metres, are you aware of any issues that arise as a result of applying a contour?
Yes, I think she's more qualified to answer that than me.
I've scanned the summary.
Yes.
Recovery of that.
Yeah. No worries. values that have been assessed through tenure review, and I suppose it's of interest that of the number of Hardy High Country farms, we haven't had those reports submitted as evidence, which is of interest to me. So if there is opportunity for that, I'll follow up.
Sounds like
really fun spot. Thank you. Yes.
Great. I'll grab the microphone because I might be a bit. Right, I'll have a read through and try and pick up the main points. So I agree with what Ms. Picard presented at the hearing in terms of her drafting of the objectives and policies set out in her copy of Chapter 39 attached to her evidence summary. I agree with the further description of the Wahi Tupuna sites as recommended by Mr. Allison. I agree with removing the urban areas from being subject to the rules of Chapter 39, earthworks subdivision and the use of the areas in the urban environment section of the plan to define this. And specifically, we should touch on the west of the Hawea Township and just make sure that that gets removed. After listening to Council's opening and reviewing Ms. Picard's evidence, I agree that it is not necessary to include mapping of the wider Wanaka area, the area around central Queenstown and Frankton. I agree with Ms. Picard that the notification of all discretionary and non-complying activities is inappropriate. Policy 39.2.1.2 and the list of values in Schedule 39 provide enough guidance for notification when activities require a discretionary or non-complying resource consent. I agree with Ms. Picard's statement about Mr. Bathgate's amendments to Policy 39.2.1.6 creating a broader policy that creates uncertainty. I agree with Ms. Picard's amendments in her evidence summary presented at the hearing. And the following points I don't agree with Ms. Picard. Amending the elevation of where farm buildings and earthworks are restricted within the Wahi Tupuna area above the 400 metres above sea level mark. I have gone back to the topographic maps of the district and confirmed there are many areas around the Upper Clutha where homesteads and pastoral farming occur around 400 to 500 metres above sea level. And if you want, I can jump on the computer and go through the topo maps if you'd like later on. Earthworks are frequently carried out at these elevations, that's between 400 to 500 metres above sea level, and these may not be covered by the exclusion for farming earthworks under Rule 25.3.2.10, but they and are also under the previously permitted 1,000 metres cubed rural earthwork standard, and they therefore didn't require consent. I agree with Mr. Edgar's position this morning in his presentation that perhaps more guidance can be provided by Runaka as to the skyline or terrace edges that are not to be modified under proposed Rule 25.5.22, because this would aid in more certainty for applicants and council processing consent applications. Upon listening to Mr. Devlin present his evidence last week, I do think there is value in further specifying the threats or triggers, as he might like to call them, in each Wahi Tupuna area, as terms like buildings and subdivision and development are quite broad and capture most activities. It would be worth the panel discussing whether these terms can be refined with Runaka, as leaving the terms quite broad will result in large quantities of applications for consultation which may not be required. For example, are there particular scales of buildings or particular intensive kinds of development that are of concern, or is it areas down by the lakefront that are of concern within Queenstown and Wanaka? It's sort of a point to talk to with them about. And a point was raised with Ms. Picard at the hearing around whether Akaha or Runaka had the capacity to deal with increased applications for consultation. Ms. Picard responded that she had liaised with Akaha, who had taken on extra staff and was therefore satisfied that they would have enough capacity. Very recently, I submitted an application with Akaha for consultation on a building platform within a Wahi Tupuna area. This was only last week or the week before, and received a response in late June which stated that the processing was going to take at least 4 to 5 working weeks because of their current workload. And I say this not as a dig at Akaha, but to emphasise why the threats in Schedule 39.6 should be reviewed and possibly streamlined, and how reducing the number of earthworks consultations would assist our kaha as well as applicants.
Thank you, Ms. Mann. Can you just assist me? I'm looking at the maps. Thank you very much for saving us the time of going through.
Yeah, I know you asked Mr. Edgar this morning for a list, so.
Which of I could look up the address, but which of the Makarora settlements is this?
I can show you on a wider map, but maybe Mr. Todd can talk to it a bit further.
No, just is it the north, south, or the one in the middle?
I think it's the closest one to the lake. South, yeah.
South, yeah.
South, yeah. And the site of interest is over the road in black.
It is, when I typed in the address this morning, it was the area to the just to the north of the yellow, that sort of long strip of land.
Rectangular shape.
Yeah.
Of a lesser shade, lighter shading.
Gotcha. But the same side of the road as the settlement?
Yes.
Immediately to the north of the settlement?
Yep. Yes.
Two or three questions, Ms. Brown. The first relates to your suggested revision of policy 39213.
Let me grab that.
Query I have is whether converting it to a simple avoid, remedy, mitigate policy fails to implement policy 222 of the RPS and policy 3338 of chapter 3, both of which require in different ways avoidance of significant adverse effects.
Yep, I had a look at this, and then after Ms. Pickard presented her evidence at the hearing the other week, I thought that her drafting in her part attached to her evidence summary dealt with that issue a bit clearer, so I'm happy to go with Ms. Pickard's approach on that.
Talking about potential for using different elevations. The logic in Mr. Bathgate's evidence is to cover effectively the falls of the valleys where earthquakes are not likely to raise. Manifold issues. And of course, as with any arbitrary line, you can always chip, say, well, if 395 MASL is okay, why is 405 a problem? Do we have, is there an issue, if you go higher, that, for instance, 400 MASL relative to Lake Wanaka, mm-hmm. is quite different to relative to Lake Hawea, much lower, and
yep.
there's that much more the terrace flats around the lake are at a correspondingly lower altitude than they are in Hawea. Do we need to look at each area and say, well, what difference does it make at that location?
Yes, possibly. I think it was Mr. Allison's evidence talked about not only protecting areas that you could look up to that were of value, but also mentioned something about creating efficiencies for people who were carrying out farming activities. So I took that into account first, but you are right, it may need an approach where you look at individual wahi tupuna areas and create a carve out at different elevations, although that creates problems in itself with multiple, just makes the whole chapter a bit more confusing. But when I had a look at the topographic maps around, especially around Hawea, there are a lot of homesteads between 400 and 500 metres above sea level, a lot of paddocks, and things like that, which if you did leave it at 400 metres above sea level, there's going to be a lot more applications for just day-to-day farming activities, which will just add to a whole lot of burden for applicants as well as Akaha processing consents. So I can drive you around in a way on a topographical map to show you the areas that I was looking at if you'd like, but I might also have one printed copy of things that I was referring to this morning if you'd like me to have it to show you.
You have them in the back of your evidence, so
yep.
I think we've got the drift. I think that the issue that I was more concerned about was not so much the point you were making there as regard the properties you were pointing to, but rather if you applied that as a blanket rule, whether that rule would also be appropriate on the Queenstown side of the hill, where the lake is lower, and therefore the farmed terraces are generally lower as well.
Yeah, so it could be that the best outcome is to create a carve out in each wahi tupuna area for the different elevation that should apply.
Thank you, Commissioner Cheever.
Any questions
for this part? I wonder if it was fair to speculate that after lockdown, a lot of consultants might have a backlog for a month or two. I think more around the elevation, I think we've covered it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
At the risk of being repetitive, the other thing is just working through some of your objective and policy arguments. One of the and this is the first objective, which in your evidence in chief support that we're reading that was proposed. I think through others is that this chapter is headed by the Tupuna, and the purpose talks about dealing with provisions within the identified part of the Tupuna. And objective one, for me, seems to be much broader, not just the Midway. Do you agree with that? And if you do, what's the purpose of this objective here, or should it be limited to the identified lake?
I think that this objective draws your attention to the identified wahi tupuna areas, but also makes you aware that there may be values that fall outside of the areas which you may need to take into consideration.
So there's something you would support?
I like that it's focused, that it draws your attention to the identified areas, but I think you may need to be aware of, if there was an area surrounding a nearby a lake or a waterway that wasn't covered by a wahi tupuna area, then maybe that needs to make you think, is it worth consulting with Akaha?
Is there any sense that that's inconsistent or not entirely consistent with chapters 3 and 5, the provisions that are already there, which seem to me to...
Oh, you mean it's almost doubling up?
Mm.
Okay. Just give me a second to have a look at chapter. I think I've got the Tangata Whenua chapter, and may also have that. Do you have reference to the specific?
I haven't got them in front of me, but I was looking at them, and they tend to talk about a broader concept. I mean, some of them talk about signalling this chapter.
Yep.
There are some broader strategic ones which clearly talk about, in terms of Section 6, the relationship issue and the values of Mana Pena as a whole. But it seems to me they apply across the entire district, whereas these provisions, as I understood them, were to be within the identified areas.
Yep.
And hence, was there, if we're going down this route of looking for more certainty, I suppose the question does that I pose to you is,
yep,
the way that objective is framed, does that provide more certainty or less?
No, I think now that you've explained that, I think you are right, it does provide a bit of uncertainty. I guess the way I read it was that it was a reminder to look at other objectives and policies.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. I think what you're saying is if it's retained, it's intended to imply wider than,
yep,
the second question I've got, and it comes to policy 39213 that the chair talked about. Got a couple of questions, and there it says recognise of certain activities. It's a question I've been posing, what are those certain activities?
Yeah.
I think Mr. Devlin talked about maybe the threats. You referred to the threats. Well, what do you think those certain activities are?
I think Ms. Pickard's amendments, what has she got here? I think that does, I would, in my head, if I was reading that, I would then refer to the threats. But I also think that we need to touch on the threats may need to be narrowed a bit as well.
And I suppose we'll come back to that schedule,
yep,
in a moment. And just, again, I just want to be clear in your answer to the chair on, in terms of paragraph 21 of your evidence achieved,
yep,
in terms of that policy, where you say Mr. Bathgate's drafting is what should be simplified to. I interpret that as this is what you're suggesting is appropriate. Is that my reading that correctly? So what you,
yes,
say, what you say in 21 is what you think the policy should be.
Yep.
And hence I raise the same question with the chair. And what sort of guidance does it give? It does say to avoid the being mitigated. How does that take you any further than say what the Act already says at Section 5 you must do? How does it give any guidance? Because the way that Ms. Pickard and Mr. Barth had it, they're trying to separate them, avoid the significant fines and avoid the
Commissioner, I think Ms. Barnes said, having reflected on,
yep,
further, she's retreated and shifted ground.
Sorry, that's,
yep,
what I was unclear on.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So, right, so
yep,
that's not your position.
No,
I
had a look at Ms.
Right.
Pickard's,
right,
evidence,
okay,
and I think she's drafted it.
And then just coming to the question that I signalled to Todd is,
yep,
if the objectives and policies are to focus on the values that are held,
yep,
and whatever the final policy wording comes out, if it's avoid significant on those values, can you address that issue of whether you think what's specified in the sheet of 39.6 around the values and the description and the threats, whether you think that's sufficiently clear? So, say you as a professional practitioner, others when they're looking at it, can understand clearly what it is, what the values are to either to be avoided or to be remediated.
I think what Mr. Todd had said as well, if the values were sort of more succinct or pinpointed or something like that, then it does make it easier for somebody helping an applicant apply for a consent to figure out exactly where the values apply and what they maybe, and then and to tie in with that, if the threats were narrowed down, then that gives you a clear idea of how that threat is going to impact that value. So I think if we could, yeah, narrow the threats down, and if there is a chance you could map the values a bit clearer, that would really help.
When you're saying we, what are you meaning? I mean, are you suggesting that there not be, and I don't mean that pejoratively, I mean,
yep.
Are you suggesting that they're not yet clear enough and they need to be, or you think that they're sufficiently clear that you can work with them in terms of representing or giving advice to your clients to understand what the threats, the values would
be? I would look at the values and have difficulty, but if they were mapped, it would make it a lot simpler.
Right. So,
more having
thank you.
Yep.
Kind of looking at the western end of Hawea Township.
Yes, yes.
Where the site number two, I think this goes across the urban area.
Yep.
Do you think that's just an error? When you look at the whole of the map site, it does, the eastern end doesn't come up to the boundary of the township,
because
the western end overlays the boundary. I mean, in your view, could that be a minor correction?
I'm not 100% sure if it's an error, but in, was it Mr. Allison's evidence, he supported the removal of the Wahi Tupuna overlay from urban areas. And so even if it wasn't a minor amendment that you could make, I guess Runanga support the removing of Wahi Tupuna areas from urban areas. So.
Different evidence
okay.
on that,
yep.
and that I think sometimes when people are talking about removing the Wahi Tupuna from the urban areas, they're talking about removing the effect of the rules,
okay.
but not necessarily removing the mapping.
Okay.
And I think Ms. Pickett's talked about leaving the mapping over the urban areas, including Wanaka, and putting them into Wanaka and Franklin. But not having a rule applied.
Mm-hmm.
But in the hardware situation, are you saying that the mapping shouldn't apply, that the values aren't there, that doesn't seem consistent with the description of that Wahi Tupuna?
I couldn't comment on whether values of that Wahi Tupuna area apply to that site, but if you were taking the evidence of Runaka to remove the mapping from urban areas, apart from, I think it was Wanaka, Queenstown and Frankton, then this shouldn't apply, then this overlay shouldn't apply on the western end of Hawea Township.
So your evidence on the removal of this area from
yep.
Hawea is
yep.
based entirely on what you say they have said,
yes.
as opposed to any investigation of the accuracy of that mapping,
yes.
or its application in a logical place on the ground, or
yes.
whatever.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And looking at paragraph 34, I think this, you talk about there being no threats listed for the urban areas, and I think you are meaning the Wanaka, Queenstown,
yes.
Frankton urban areas.
Yes.
I think, does it just say something like there are no threats?
It
threats?
Does in
yeah.
the notified schedule. And so that was if I took that view, if there was a proposal put forward that said, I think it was by Runanga, that said if discretionary or non-complying activities were applied for in the town centres, Queenstown, Wanaka, Frankton, then it should be an automatic notification to Aokaha. And so if that applied, I said, shouldn't we refine it a bit and have threats, because there could be a tiny non-compliance, like a breach of a sign rule or something like that, which may not trigger values. However, on hearing Ms. Picard's presentation, I agree with her that the mapping of the urban areas shouldn't apply, and the discretionary and non-complying proposal that Runanga put forward shouldn't be followed.
The first point you just described is an interesting point, which I don't think anyone's put to us before, that if the mapping is retained over any urban area, particularly those three major ones where there are no threats, and that then means that discretionary or non-complying applications have to take into account that mapping of the Waikato Kura, then your evidence is that there should be some identification of the threats in order to narrow what would be need to be looked at.
Because subdivision and development is everything that happens in the town centre.
And that's another part of your evidence, is that if you are going to identify threats, saying subdivision and development or in buildings and structures covers most everything.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's not narrowing at all.
Yep.
All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Spell.
Just following on the threats discussion, if there was an activity that would trigger a rule but wasn't identified as a threat under that Waihi Tupuna thing, is any further assessment of the values disregarded then? Or do you then still proceed to, I suppose what I'm trying to get at, is the list of threats exhausted? Does it account for every possible thing that could occur, or is it exclusive?
I think it would act as a guide to tell you, but it's a hard one to answer without a specific example in front of me. But
it seemed to me that there's possibly some inconsistency between the threats and the activities.
Mm-hmm.
In one case there was a value that identified Mahina Kai as the value of that particular area, but then referred to the impacts on ridgelines and skylines, for instance.
Yep.
So I'm just trying to work out, could a building on a skyline be deemed to be having an impact on Mahina Kai?
I guess you'd have to talk to Runaka about that. But I see your point about, is the threats list exhausted?
If it's not exhausted, does it have any role?
Mm.
Or is it an interpretation note?
I think it does provide guidance. And I guess I would, if I was applying for a consent on behalf of somebody and the activity wasn't listed with as a threat, then it wouldn't be my default position to consult with iwi unless it triggered a rule or what have you. But
aren't we required to consult with iwi? If you triggered a rule?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, you're sorry.
You can see the problem that I'm trying to flesh out is that there does seem to be if there's something that's not identified as a threat, is council required to then continue to consult with evil, or is it just that they just move on? Issue consent and move on?
Can I think about that
come
back to you?
There might not be an answer.
One would expect if the notation was on the property and the activity was undertaken within that area, that it's almost going to be a default situation that you're going to have to consult.
And is that a problem? If it hasn't been identified, if the activity hasn't been identified as a threat to that value?
Well, again, it comes back to the situation of the landowner flying in the dark. If they don't know what the threats and values are, how can they manage the day-to-day running of their properties? And this is the whole point that we're trying to get to.
Yeah, which would then imply that the threat should guide whether the activity is a problem or not.
Correct.
And if it doesn't, then, yeah.
Yeah.
So you can see that, yeah.
It's a circular argument, almost.
It's a circular argument.
Joe, can I just ask you to pause there, Commissioner? Is that really any different to the normal situation? You don't. Like, I'm thinking of, I can think of any number of regional and district plans that have generalised mana whenua provisions that don't identify specific threats. Effectively, the onus is on the landowner if they're undertaking an activity which requires consent to consider whether those policies might apply, to consult, to gain information on other federal values, to generally by consultation.
That's exactly the point that we're trying to make. What is the need for the notations over the properties? You have to do that anyway. There's a requirement for you to undertake these. So the point I was trying to make, and I'm sorry if it wasn't clear, is that by imposing these notations, you're almost assuming that there is something there which you don't know anything, you've got no information available to you as to what it is.
Well, I suppose the essence is, are you any worse off that the value of the notations is for the land that is not notated? It's not for the land that is notated, because in those areas you're in the same position, and you would be in with a very general provision saying that mana whenua values are potentially relevant.
Well, so do we now assume that if you're not mapped, they're not relevant?
Well, at least there's some other indication in the plan. So, as I say, it might be the wrong end of the telescope.
Mm.
Sorry, Commissioner, I interrupted you. I was following that chain of thought.
Mm.
And so we touched on the mapping of the urban areas. You sort of, I suppose, acknowledged that the removal of the Waihita Puna mapping over the urban areas was appropriate. We heard evidence earlier that there are cases, in the case of Kingston, where the special zone was removed from the Waihita Puna mapping. The same applied in Kajarana, where this settlement or rural visitor zone was removed from the mapping. I suppose what in your view is the correct approach? Should those areas, if there's a value, should those areas still be mapped and the provisions reflect the activities that can occur, or should the mapping be removed from those areas?
So you're talking about a scenario where the rules don't apply in the rural visitor zone?
Well, I'm trying to understand that the value either exists or it doesn't,
yep,
regardless of the zoning. But the zoning may provide for different rights depending on the acceptability of those activities. And in the case of Hawea, in this case, they're clearly accepting that residential activity will occur within an area mapped as currently mapped as Waihita Puna.
Mm-hmm.
Does the presence of that activity mean the value doesn't exist, or should the mapping be removed?
I think you'll need to talk to Runaka about.
Yeah, sure we will. And the only other question I had is that Hawea is a unique situation, that it's a flooded, it's a dammed lake. Do you have any guidance to us as whether that creates any issues around how the rules or the mapping of the Waihita Puna is affected?
I think, again, you'll probably have to talk to Runaka about that.
And Mr. Burden.
Yep.
I think that's all for
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks.
So, Clark, how do you want to proceed from here with your lay?
Yes, I'm going to call I'm going to call the witnesses up individually, and they can present their evidence. Those that are presenting formally, and the others are available for questioning at the conclusion of the formal presentations. So, I call Mr. Jerry Bird. We have copies available.
Afternoon, panel. My name is...
Just wait a moment. They haven't got your evidence yet. Don't jump too quickly.
Restrain them and do that.
Yes.
Good afternoon, panel. My name is Jeremy Burden. I've lived on the property of Glendean for nearly 80 years, and the Burden family have owned the property for 91 years. We have a very strong affinity and caring attitude for this area of land that we live on. The past historical decision regarding Maori are open to criticism. The government has some duties to them under the treaty, which we acknowledge, but they also have duties to private landowners, as we own our title of the land. It is not Crown land. Therefore, making provision for Maori through this wahi tapuna process is a dubious way of doing it. For one thing, there has been no consultation with the legal landowner. All we got was a letter from the Queenstown District Council after the process had been formally notified. That is not the correct process. From the bottom end of Lake Hawea, i.e. the southern end, it has been presumed they walked as far as they could, depending on the lake level. One of the main reasons they could not have walked on our land was because the main restricted area was very high with dense bracken fern and bluffs around the edge of the lake. If they'd walked on any land at all, it was either now under the lake or owned by Lynn's, not us, at Glendean. We understand that the Maoris made rafts from the flaxhead seeds to travel up the lake, and this was their main transport when travelling on the lake, once again, not our land. The known area on our property that the Maoris had a connection to was an area we referred to as the Neck. This area, which is adjacent to Lake Wanaka. Up there was a small lagoon, which was a great food resource for them in the way of eels and wekas. This area became known as a summer retreat, where they had a temporary camp and resting place. As the Maoris were known to be coastal people and had therefore travelled from the east coast, this area was a stopping off place to the west coast. The other place which they stopped over for a camp was where the Craigburn Creek flows into the Lake Hawea now, owned by Doc, but not our land. For some reason, unbeknown to us, that area is not treated the same as private land. In 1906, an area of 40 hectares was allocated to the Maoris under the Landless Natives Act. This area surrounded our pastoral lease at the time. It went down to the lake. It went down to the lagoon. There was a little flat land round the edge of the lagoon, but most of it surrounded the land was quite steep. When the lake was raised in the late 50s by 28 metres for storage water for hydro, to go back and request more land or any other assistance to ask for electricity purposes, the Maoris lost a quarter of this area. The remaining area, which had its own freehold title, was sold in 1971 to the owners of the Hunter Valley Station. There is much said about this area of land, but the truth of the matter is that the Crown well and truly compensated the Maoris for this piece of land. They gained from it in an area of land in Wanaka referred to as the Sticky Forest. We also lost a large area of our lower country, which we have greatly missed as it was important to the balance of the property. However, we have never had the opportunity to ask for more or flavours. When Glendine went through the tenure review process in 2004, an area of 40 hectares was granted to Ngātahu by their own request. To this day, nothing has been done with this piece of land. Normally, it would be managed and cared for. Thank you.
Mr. Burden, just a clarification. I'm aware that before the lake was raised, I think the natural level was around 324 MASL,
yes.
And the hydro range is now 338 to 346.
346.
So 346 at the top. And wouldn't that equate to in distance across the ground? Like that's the elevation change. But how much, if you were walking from what's currently the lake edge down to the natural lake edge, how far would it have been? I understand that it would depend on how steep it was, but typically at the bottom of
I would think from where we live, it would be a distance of at least 400 to 500 metres. The only real flat area was up at the Craigburn, where it would have gone out a lot further. But because we were on probably a 15 degree slope, the distance wouldn't have been great. But I do know that with the road and the raising of the lake, we lost 700 acres of land.
And was there a road at much lower elevation than?
Well, it was all the land, most of the land, well, up to an area of about 10 k's north of of Glendine, up to what we refer to as Dinner Flat. It was more gradual, like a sort of a 15 degree slope. There was an area between the Craigburn and Dinner Flat that was a bit steeper, but the majority was a lower slope.
So just check that where I wasn't writing fast enough. You said that between the road and the lake raising, you lost about 700 acres.
Yes. That's what we were compensated for.
Thank you, Commissioner Cheetham.
Sorry, you'll just have to speak up because I can't hear, please.
You said you were compensated for the loss of the city.
Yes, we were compensated.
Sites and values are on
You'll have to define that a bit more. I don't quite understand your question.
So in growing up, you obviously got a strong connection to that piece of land. I'm just interested to know whether you, in growing up, you said, oh, well, that's where the Marys used to camp when they came up here, or that's where they used to collect something or other.
Well, I do remember the little lagoon quite well, actually, but there was no historical evidence when I was walking around the area. There was nothing. No, there wasn't.
So you're not aware of any particular evidence on the site?
No,
but you're
no.
Aware of
and when we were doing our tenure review, we did have an archaeologist that came up and looked all around that area there, and we didn't locate anything. The only thing we located was possibly something at Dinner Flat, where they thought the moat was where they'd had a fire. Not actually a hangi, just a small. You could see it with the profile of the gravel. But there was no evidence of anything.
And is it possible that a number of those sites might be underwater?
I would say so, because that 25, the area was 100 acres, and they lost 25 acres, and a lot of that was more the area where they would have had their camp.
Okay, that's all, thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
Mr. Vernon, when the 40 hectares that was granted to Ngaitahu through your tenure review process...
No, that's separate. The landless natives, they got 100 acres or 40 hectares.
And just look, if you could just look at the last paragraph of what you read out, number paragraph 13.
Yes.
You said when Glenzine went through the tenure review process, an area of 40 hectares was granted to Ngaitahu by their request.
Yes.
Where's that? Was that at the... Was that in the neck area?
Yeah, in the neck area.
Yes.
Initially, they asked for about 240 hectares, and we had to go to the Lands Department at the time because we maintained that was an outrageous amount of area that wanted. So we managed to get them down to an area of about 40 hectares, and that is right at the crest of the road going from Hawea to Wanaka.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Next generation, Mr. Richard Burden.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, the 40 hectares that we were recently just talking about that was taken out of the pastoral lease, it actually involved several days of quiet negotiation with the iwi, the local Te Runga, who came over because A, we were trying to establish the important values that and cultural values that belonged up in that area, and so the 40 hectares has been invested in DOC and managed under DOC for special interests. So it wasn't allowed to be freeholded, which was a bit of frustration for the local iwi who really at the time of the tenure review wanted it to be put into their own freehold title, but that under the tenure review process that wasn't allowed to happen.
Is
that the land that was the subject of a land swap for Sticky Forest?
No, so there's two areas we talk about at the Neck, and there's the freehold, which was part of the, through the Māori Land Court, that was flooded and then sold in 1971, that my father talked about. And when that part of Sticky Forest was part of a settlement for that. So there's been some long-standing issues with Māori in the Neck region, because they did actually, and we do recognise that they did have some cultural values, and you know, the cultural values report talks about it, but you know, when you go through tenure review, it was a process that took us 7 years, and we did our own research, and we went and found the screeds of letters. I've got letters and documents here from 1860s right through to a lot of documents in the 1980s and stuff, and so we had to do a lot of our own research, and we've got the property details are very, very clear here about what was important to local iwi, and that's why I suppose you get a district plan maps and stuff like that, and it appears as completely new evidence, and we can't understand where it was going. So the Waitapu overlay identified in the proposed district planning maps, we really want them deleted from our property, because in all the cultural assessment report, it's gone way too far and have introduced completely new areas. Of course, it's been said many times today there was no consultation with the affected parties, which we find is totally unacceptable. And the fact that there is no consultation between us, the landowners, and prior notifications, it's not really good enough for us. My time as a farmer has become quite frustrating. I'm overrun with just trying to keep up with local government rules and regulations. Glendine has to employ more farm staff simply because I can't get out on the farm. We've had to hire more consultants and employ lawyers like Graham here, who, when I ever speak to him, he's always up to his eyeballs and trying to sort out, you know, more district plan stuff. So we've got to get back to, you know, the basics in the real world. And, you know, the district plan was meant to be about making life simpler and better, but I'm finding I'm under more and more constraints all the time under the local government rules, which has a substantial effect, financial burden on our property. The raising of Lake Hawea has had a monumental change to the lake and its surrounds. And, you know, Dad talked about the road. The Haast Highway wasn't actually officially open until about 1996, because, you know, it took many years to open the road, and much of it was flooded. And I can remember as a child growing up, and we've lost, if you ever drive up the west coast, there's the area going over the Hawea Lookout, and all that road was taken off us, and all that, there's another 40 hectares of land taken from us because of the erosion that was causing from the lake. So it all needs to be noted, as many of these claims made by the Waitapu are now lost or underwater. And this was discussed with the Crown and Ngāi Tahu during the tenure review process. Drawing lines on the map now today without even consulting us and reviewing these reports. Now, you actually, they are public documents, but you have to do an OIA to get them under the Official Information Act, because these have got quite cultural and sensitive issues, so that they're not. If you go into, you can go into a LINS report at a tenure review level, and there's quite a lot of information, but to get the real detailed stuff, you have to do an official information, because it does hold sensitive iwi information. During the tenure review process, Ngāi Tahu were present throughout the whole process, and they were consulted. We had several days of on-site meetings. We feel now back. We feel now with these lines back on the map that it's a bit like double dipping, and we do not believe that they are asking for what they are asking for has sound merit. These are new areas that were never mentioned or even discussed in the tenure review process. We had several very high level meetings with Ngāi Tahu that the LINS staff flew down from Wellington and organised the Tauranga, and all the local senior Ngāi Tahu people were there. So we find it quite unbelievable that these new things have popped up, and we just don't really know how they can be justified. I've lived and farmed on the property for nearly 40 years in the Burton family, as my father mentioned, 91. And so we have a strong affinity and a caring attitude for the area that we live in. And we do acknowledge that there is historical and past areas where the iwi lived up around the neck. But these were dealt with during treaty settlements. And again, they're all in this book here, and they're well documented, and there's plenty of historical information if you prepared to spend hours and hours searching for it. I'm not going to touch on too much of the other stuff because my father's already covered about the 40 hectares up at the neck and the importance that played. It was known as the hand area because it was where all the trails came in for the iwi when they were going through to the west coast. But the only thing I would like to add to that is that the fact that you have acknowledged that with the tenure review cultural values reports are done, the fact that you haven't realised that these cultural value reports were done during tenure review is a concern to me, that the council actually hasn't done their research properly. And that's a pretty important thing, because if you're claiming all these values and things, you actually have, in my world, you should be able to justify them. So when Glendine went through that tenure review process in 2000 to 2007, and that 40 hectare area was granted to Ngāi Tahu, we still feel a wee bit aggrieved about this, because today there's nothing that has been done with this piece of land. Yet we were told it was one of the most important pieces of land gained by Ngāi Tahu in the tenure review process in the South Island. Today it's reverted back into weeds and scrub and basically abandoned. This makes it even more difficult for us to manage the other part of our land that we still farm, as it's reverted back into the scrubs and weeds, and it makes it difficult for us to get access through up into our property. So you can imagine how our feelings are running reasonably high when this Waitapu was put forward and claims that we didn't believe was substantial made. So sometimes councils and governments can do a lot of damage to communities if they don't consult adequately and properly understand some of the historical perspectives from our sides and from all sides. So thank you. Yes. That's the 40 hectares that was taken out of the tenure review.
So that's what you're referring to at the paragraph 13?
Yes, that's been reverted back into weeds. And we've talked to the Tauranga local iwi, and we were keen for them to do something with it, but there's nothing happened in it. And so we don't It's disappointing for us to see it just growing weeds and.
But the Department of Conservation is responsible for its day-to-day management.
It's meant to be a joint management. It's meant to be joint, but it is owned by the Department of Conservation. But if it was that important to iwi, we were disappointed that they haven't, you know, done something with it. Well, there's millions of tourists go through these areas every year. It's probably one of the most photographed areas in the country, and if these cultural values and you know, that could be a sign could be erected or something could be erected if it was important. There could have been an interpretive walkway, it could have been many things. And so New Zealanders and tourists all around this country probably don't understand the importance iwi played in some of these areas because there's nothing ever said or told to us on these journeys around the country. I mean, and so all these things that are claimed, how can you educate and tell people about them if the land's just left abandoned?
I just think one other clarification, so I've just driven out the gateways earlier on today. Can you mention Craigburn Creek where it flows into Lake Collier? I don't know if you've got an addressing or a way of getting that up on the map, but I was just...
It's, if you pan down a fraction, I'll be able to... Borrow Richie's. Have you got your? A fraction more. So, that's Craigburn area there. So there was an area of around 45 acres, I think. Quite a big flat around that area. It's basically with the operating easement, you know, it's high tide, there's some one of the biggest freedom camping spots in the country now, so if you guys have got important values there, then you're not getting them very well protected because the freedom campers are basically packed in there.
Subject of about considerable annoyance given your other interests further south, Mr. Burton.
Yes.
Mr. Dawson?
No, I think this
is. Mr. Smith?
Just one question, I suppose, with your knowledge of the history of the background of the area and some of these processes. We had some evidence last week of some.
No hunger.
That have been identified around Lake Hawea, and there's one at the Hawea campground. There's also one at Kinsbush and one at Timaru Creek, I understand. Are you able to tell me when they were allocated and how that occurred?
Probably best to speak to Sarah on that one, Councillor Quinton.
I can assist. They're part of the Ngāi Settlement Act, and they're scheduled in that act.
In roughly what period?
1998. Yeah, about, I think, 98?
Yeah.
Yeah, about 98.
Yeah, 98.
Thank you. And are you, maybe Mr. Todd can assist, are you able to tell me whether they were substitute blocks or whether they were identified as specific
areas? Identified, as I understand, of food gathering areas.
Some of
they weren't of high significant value, they were just areas that were on the lake that they could occupy.
Thank you. So
as part of the settlement.
So effectively substitutes for previous.
That's correct.
And were they all pieces of Crown land previously?
They're reserves,
And so presumably if they had a historic campsite, it would now be underwater.
That's correct.
And so that these were done in substitute for
And so they could still camp, and that's absolutely.
And they are still, they are used by local iwi, and there is rules that go with them, and we don't have a problem with it next door to us at the campground.
Thank you. I'm mostly interested in whether they're identified with specific values in mind or whether they're substitutes, and I appreciate you answering that question. No further questions today.
Thank you.
Leave this spreadsheet.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burden.
Thank you.
Call Mr. Burden's wife, Sarah Burden.
Good afternoon.
Just wait until we circulate the evidence, please.
Good afternoon. Mine's probably a bit lighter, but I'm a. My name's Sarah Burden, and I'm a fifth generation Australian.
I think you should keep that up, you.
But my family has farmed as well, and we had a family farm in Australia, and I was a fifth generation on that farm. I've lived at Glendine Station, Lake Howeir, for 20 years, and I'm married, obviously, to Richard. His family's farmed in Glendine for three generations. I married a farmer. My children attended Howeir Flat School and they've participated in many kapa haka. Today we're joined by Richard's parents and we also have two children, Georgie and Charlie, 15 and 17, and they're keen on farming and would like to, at this moment, would like to carry on the family farming business for the next generation to come. So as Richard pointed out, he is a different farmer today than when I met him. I don't see him out on the farm very often. I see him obviously in his office doing a lot of compliance and dealing with a lot of issues. High country farming is not easy, for anyone that knows that. A flat farm is usually very profitable and a high country farm is just a completely different kettle of fish. So for those that don't know, it is very challenging environmentally, economically and socially. And caretaking of the land requires a lot of passion and determination because there's not usually a lot of income that's driven off that. We've had to adapt, obviously, over the years with a lot of changing markets regularly, and we've got to change our ways and take into consideration the present environments and considering the future ones. And that's caused us to continuously adapt our business. And as a consequence, we've introduced agritourism, a hunting business, as well as adopting the campground, which was south of Glendine, into the mix. And we're neighbours with the Nohonga site. With this, we're already dealing with a lot of red tape and compliance. The district plan process has been very stressful for us. And it quite often takes us away from our core business and it's costing us a lot of money, time and stress. And from a tourism perspective, it has been extremely difficult trying to operate in rural general and already and also in O&L. And a lot of that is to do with the rules and, and especially the landscaping rules. So even putting a shed in the camp, which we need for operational, is really challenging, and it's very stressful and costly, and quite often the cost of putting the shed in costs more in compliance than it does for the shed, and hence why we haven't put one in. And we've had to buy one off the campsite. We've had to make lots of decisions to the detriment and conflicting with our vision, a vision to continue to be sustainable in a changing environment. The district plan, to me and many others, is put into place to get rid of the red tape and put rules and guidelines into place that we follow so that we can get on with our core business. However, I'm here today to really talk to you and identify that it is actually all these district plans and these processes are actually taking us away from what we're protecting and working on our land and dragging us into an office. So today I'd like to ask the council why we need another layer of red tape on our land. I'm not objecting to the importance of Wahi Tupuna, but I am objecting to it going into the district plan. I studied ecotourism at Flinders University in South Australia, and I'm passionate about sustainability. Ecotourism is all about the interpretation of the land and being sustainable so that the next generations can enjoy the land and places. We're familiar with Māti Katahanga, I'm not very good on the Māori, sorry, and Kaitai Katanga, and we endorse that ourselves with offering high country hospitality, and we pride ourselves of being caretakers, custodians of the land for the next generations. I've just taken this little insert out of our camp business plan where it says the Mana Katanga. It says we believe in offering high country hospitality to our guests, welcoming strangers into our park and having them leaving as friends. A kaitai katanga is to look after our land, be custodians, always minimalising any environmental effects, for our staff and our guests to realise the importance, how special our surrounds are and the energy it produces. We, the Burden family, are a giving family business. We have always shared our land with others, and tourism provides us with a great opportunity to do this, to offer commercial recreation activities. Activities that may be incompatible with values and identified in Wahi Tupuna areas. Activities that are classified as recognised threats. We've been through tenure review, as we pointed out, and this was time where Māori could identify areas of great significance. We've been through a number of resource consent processes where Māori also have the opportunity to participate in these processes. However, we object to another layer of impending on the district plan where there are other avenues to achieve better results. We feel that there was not a need to draw lines on a map, that the whole of New Zealand is culturally and spiritually significant to the Māori and their different iwis. I have since understood that there is a difference between cultural and spiritual, and that commercial gain is also important, as per the Ngāti Tahu website. I do not feel that we've been properly consulted as landowners, and I know that this is not the way of the Māori. I've spoken to a lot of my friends, and they are actually quite horrified by the way that we have been where there has been a lack of consultation, because they do not believe that this is their way. However, I also believe that we should be a fair and equitable society, and that the district plan should ensure that this is the case. Therefore, to put lines on a map and put rules, more rules in place, is not a solution. These rules make it harder for us to create a sustainable vision and for the next generation to continue to farm, to keep the vision alive, and or to operate commercial activities on their land. We object to putting lines on a map and more rules. We already have ONL, which is a huge protective cover and which inhibits us from putting accommodation in our own property due to the stress of the cost and the time it would cause. We feel that a solution is similar to protecting the similar to the protecting of the district waterways, we as farmers have all joined together as farmers to work together to find solutions. We meet up and discuss water quality and how, as farmers, we can work together to ensure that we improve our practices to ensure the water quality remains as a focus. We believe that this form of communication involvement is more important to protecting and conserving and understanding the and interpretation of the Wāhi Tambuna values. Lines on a map are actually discriminatory, and they are destroying the property rights of those that are current caretakers. This can destroy communities and also has huge implications on the future generations, financially and socially, making the future not sustainable for the next generation. How can you differentiate between some of Lake Hauwea and not the rest? How can you differentiate between the land around Lake Wanaka and Lake Hauwea? This is not fair. We are a hydro lake, which to us is in the rules as incompatible to what you're supposed to believe. It has already been, Lake Hauwea has already been altered, as has Wanaka, with buildings and development. We are custodians of the land, and we need protecting as much. We need protecting just as much, otherwise you will make us extinct. If it is about commercial gain, then the district plan is not the place to do this. It is for the government to deal with it in another way. If it is about spiritual values, then it is about working together to protect what needs protecting as a community, working with the guardians of the lake and the landowners. We are the landowners. We are the current guardians and the custodians of Glendean Station and the camp at Lake Hauwea. We are willing to work together, but this is not working together. This is imposing future rules on us. We have not been consulted properly, and the rules do not support the current guardians, the current stewards of the land.
Thank you, Sarah. Just answer any questions, please.
Thank you, Mr. Burton, but we've worked our way through your father and husband, and I think we've just about got to understand your position.
Thank you.
And now Mr. Burton Senior.
Some of you, Sarah, I know, I've met you before, so how do you do? Now, I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I probably will, and I would like to bring to your attention, before I read my submission, this is a book that was written by a historian in Lake Hauwea called Barbara Chin, she may be known to some of you, and her first chapter, she's got a very, very good chapter, it's called The History of the Māori in the Area. And if for anyone that's not familiar, I think we could make this available to you, and it is quite worth reading. I recommend it. So I think Graham will arrange that for me if you were interested in having it. And I've got this map here, which as you have, and I actually live in this section of the lake here. Glendean is, the homestead is there, our house is there, and it has got the lines on it. And I'm not happy about the lines, and I'm going to tell you why. But if you want any details of where our actual house is and why I'm not happy, I shall let you know. I have also brought with me the letter that I received several days after the announcement in the district plan of these lines. So that's something that's made me very angry, but you can read the letter if you have not had a copy of it. My name is Leslie Burden, and I live in an area of land that has been subdivided off Glendean Station at Lake Hauwea. I am asking that the Waitapuna overlay identified on the proposed district plan maps be deleted from our property. Now, I have done a lot of research on that. This is not in here, but my research tells me that a lot of the areas where the Māori's camped, and I know where they are, I think, was not on the area of our property that's marked on your map. A lot of the camps were near food resources. Now, where we live and where the main homestead is was not a food resource. In fact, when I first moved there, which is a long time ago now, I grew raspberries for 4 years before I even had a bird on the place. They just weren't there. When my husband was feeding out the stock and grain and hay, that's when some of the birds came. but it was not a food resource, that area. There's been no consultation. Now, I know that's been thrashed to death, and I'm an old hand, but consultation is important. Not only is it important, it was an important part of the council process. It seems to have been a bit diluted in latter years, but above all of that, apart from it being a law that was, it's good manners, and we can operate far better as a community if we use some good manners. The approach by central government, and I know they were involved in this process, QLDC and Ngāi Tahu, to put arbitrary lines on a broad area of land as Waitapuna is definitely not appropriate. It's not the way to do it. The fact that there has been no consultation between us and the landowners prior to the notification is inexcusable. Consultation is a legal requirement and must be meaningful to be effective. This has not been meaningful. As landowners and having a title to our land, we must be consulted, as we've got property rights. Now, they are quite a strong thing in life. They give us some certainty. We are the owners of the title, but have not been able to have an effective part in the process till the submission stage. This is wrong. The relationship should have been a two-way process with the landowners and the instigators of the process. We still don't really know exactly what they're after. I mean, why would you have that big area of land if it's not specific? I do not believe that the Crown have the right to override the individuals as they have in this case. Freehold land is sacrosanct. This whole process has been a blatant attack on our family property rights, plus our future plans for keeping the land in the family. The council needs to be accountable, and we need to know what the objectives are of all this. We don't actually know entirely what the objectives are for doing this. Where there is an authority for this overlay, we haven't seen it. Where was the authority from it? We have not seen any evidence of that. Our land is already severely constrained by local government, which is a substantial financial burden. This process has been sprung on us and is adding to that burden. We can only spend a dollar once. We do have many calls on the income as it is, and we work hard for our returns. We don't need anything that's unnecessary. Throughout the process, I have not heard any reference to the modification of Lake Hauwea. Well, I have today, but not in any of the documentation prior to this. The raising of Lake Hauwea was a monumental change to our lake and its surrounds. The community of the day, still talked about, I might add, and the present community have been highly upset by the process. And I understand there was no known objection from Ngāi Tahu during that process of raising the lake. You must all understand that, like the rest of us, many of the things that we enjoyed on the lake have gone under the water, and we still have issues with erosion and flooding. This wasn't a simple matter, and it's still not to this day. We note that an appropriate suggestion could be to walk round the edge of the lake, where possible, on Lynn's land, but that has not been mentioned by anybody. It's also been brought to my attention that they could not have walked round, and my other members of the family have mentioned that. And it's also been suggested that it's possible that they came up higher along in the tussock area above the broken fern. But we don't know that because we haven't got the information on which this is judged. So that's Lynn's land, but there's nothing on Lynn's land. Lynn's land should be important to them because that's the bit that's under the lake, that's taken there, whatever the historical thing is. During the tenure review process, when Ngāi Tahu were present on the property, there was no expression of interest on our area of the land. So why now? That's what we don't understand, because there's nothing there. I submit that when Waitapuna overlay on the district plan maps be deleted on that portion of the land that I'm speaking of, I'm very happy to take questions on any of that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Just one for me, sir. Is it your basic proposition? If you had the opportunity to sit down with Ngāi and explain these, do you think they might have said, oh, yes, we can see this area is not culturally significant for the reasons you said, or refine the area?
Well, I think it would have been constructive. Because of what I understand about the logic, they may have a different view. We know they camped just at the beginning of the lake, Hawea. I've been informed that they had a very short temporary camp at the Cragburn Creek, and they had the lagoon site. This is all on their way. It wasn't actually permanent residence so much. It was a summer residence. But it's not on the bit of land I refer to. And then in the tenure review process, when we had lengthy discussions with a large number of Ngāi Tahu from Kaikoura right through to Invercargill, there was no reference to anything on that area of land. So we listened, and I've read several books on it. I've read Tipoi's Last Raid. I've read Julian von Haast's book. I've read a lot of books on it, asked a lot of people, been to the Hawkeland Library, been to the Historical Society here, and there is no reference to that particular area and several others. So we can't fabricate it. We can't do it because it suits today or we'd like more land. It's got to be factual. It's got to have real history.
Questions, please.
Thank you. No questions, but thank you.
Thank you.
No questions, but thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Nothing from me, Mr. President.
Do you think they've all been answered?
Yes.
It's fine, and I hope you enjoy the copy of the book.
I'll make that available.
Thank you.
Now, I mentioned, Mr. Chair, that members of the McRae family from Alpha Burn Station are available to answer any questions you may have, and I will make available a copy of the letter from Land Information New Zealand confirming that there was at no time any interest in terms of or no issues identified, sorry, by Ngāi Tahu at the time of the tenure review.
Well, and grateful for that and for the CIO and the Green
yes.
Team.
Any questions for Alpha Burn?
Just one quick question. If I will be able to help with this, when you, and I'm sure you'll pass the letter on to us, but the way you explained it before is that they looked at the site but didn't provide a report. Did they provide confirmation that there were no sites of interest or just that they didn't provide
I'll just quote from you. They looked at the whole property and the letter says, these reports note at paragraph 4.2 that Alpha Burn Station was inspected in 1995, that there were no particular sites of interest discussed and the report would be produced if requested. I can confirm that no such request for a report was made by Linz. So there was no report put to the Land Information New Zealand by Ngāi Tahu in response to the tenure review.
Yeah, and it's just not clear whether there are no values of any interest or whether there was just no report provided.
Well, there was no report provided identifying any values of any interest or any land that wanted to be protected.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Todd. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And to all
Commissioners.
Your support team, we appreciate you coming to see us and informing us of your issues, both for Mr. Todd, Ms. Mann, and the witnesses who will appear.
Oh, sorry.
You're missing one. Mr. Todd, did you?
I'm sorry, I didn't realise. I apologise.
I've got copies of my.
Yep. Sorry.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak in relation to the proposed Wahi Tipuna chapter. My name is Robert White, and I am a committee member of the Hawea Community Association with responsibility for the proposed district plan stage 3. The Hawea Community Association is based is an incorporated society established in 1989 to promote the interests needs and well-being of the Hawea community and surrounding environment. The aims of the HCA are to promote the well-being and sustainable development of the Hawea district, to foster values and actions consistent with a cohesive and nurturing community, to safeguard the interests of residents and ratepayers, to represent members in dealing with national and local authorities, corporations, companies, organisations and individuals, and to improve and beautify the environs of Hawea. I'm happy to take my submissions as read, but would like to highlight areas that are of importance to us and express our views on the current position of what is proposed. I would firstly like to draw the panel's attention to the fact that the Lake Hawea area was the only affected area with a township that was not provided with a public forum for introduction of the Wahi Tapuna early in the notification period. We did finally get a meeting with the Okaha planners and Ms. Pickard 2 days before submissions closed, which we arranged and hosted. But there was no Runaka representation provided, and this rendered the meeting basically useless from our perspective. Unfortunately, this is typical of the QLDC engagement with our community. Secondly, I've read and listened to the council and Kaitahu's expert evidence, there is a lot of discussion of urban areas and the partial removal of rules, the introduction of 3 new overlays outside the Hawea area, and with little regulatory effect. There is also discussion of new policies and schedules that are yet undeveloped. Given the ambiguity of what is currently being proposed specifically in relation to Hawea, we support the expert evidence provided by Hayley Mahone, and in the absence of any specific evidence relating to Hawea being provided by the council in Runaka, we seek removal of the Wahi Tapuna zone from the Hawea township. We wish to highlight the treatment of the Hawea cemetery and the incompatibility of the site's usage and proposed Wahi Tapuna zoning. We support the move to relax the earthworks and farm buildings provisions that relate to the rural areas of Hawea and move the boundary to 500 MASL. We also wish to reiterate our views in our submission that the Dunedin example of Wahi Tapuna is a far more specific and user-friendly application of this zoning tool. I have used the scheduled area 32 of the Dunedin 2GP as an example in our submission of a far more specific application in relation to views. I would like to note that the Tairi River is protected by a zone that ranges in width between 25 and 100 metres, not the 200 metres that has been applied to the waterways all over the QLDC area. We share the concerns raised by the Sustainable Glenorchy in submissions last week in relation to small-scale community power generation and supply, including solar panels, wind generation, hydro and distribution. We also share the concerns raised over the ability of volunteer organisations to effectively participate in planning processes, and we would welcome anything that could be done to reduce the burden on community groups that are trying to advocate for their local area. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. White.
Sorry, I've just left some of my paperwork.
Insofar as you support 500, that's for the broader, with a broader community interest in mind.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Just one brief one. I know your comments at the end there that the process is challenging for lay people and community groups, and I've often referred to the process as impenetrable for the general public. So
one question, you mentioned the Hawea Cemetery.
are you saying that it's also covered by the Wāhi Tukuna on the eastern side?
Yes.
East of the township.
Half of it, yes.
I haven't picked that up before, but I can see it on the map. Yeah, thank you.
That may be partly, I guess the Runaka would have to speak to it, but why there's that offset that you were talking about before.
Thank you very much, Mr. White.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologies to Mr.
White.
Have
you got any other witnesses?
No, I don't think so. I'll leave you in peace and look forward to seeing you later in the process.
Thank you very much to you all. We'll take a